What is the church? Why is it called a mystery? And how is it the key to the meaning of life? We'll talk about that on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. Please check it out. Hundreds of hours of great study material there, including blogs, podcasts, and starting in just a couple weeks, videos. And this is a very special podcast because it is technically the last pure podcast of Faith by Reason. Now, don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. The reason that this is the last pure podcast is because the last pure teaching podcast is because starting in a couple weeks, we are going to be simulcasting, for lack of a better term, video and audio. So I will be basically putting up videos for the upcoming teaching lessons of Faith by Reason. And there will still be audio available. I'll still put it up as a podcast for those of you who don't have the ability to watch video or would rather just listen to the audio. But just know it will be done in a video format primarily. But again, there'll still be audio. And I'm going to talk next week about why I am switching over to this video format and being on YouTube, and as well as embedded in the faithbyreason.net website. And I'll talk about that a little bit more at the end of this podcast. So let's just dive right in to, again, the final teaching Faith by Reason podcast. And we are studying the sixth dispensation, the dispensation of the church. And in the last podcast, we talked about what this dispensation was. We gave you just our basic overview of the dispensation, which we do with all the dispensations. And again, not because I'm a dispensationalist, I just believe that the Bible clearly shows there are different eras of time where God interacts with man differently. And in this dispensation, in this era of time, God interacts with the world through what's called the church. And that brings up some good questions. What is the church? Because before the so-called New Testament period, you never hear of the church. The term church is never mentioned in the Old Testament. In fact, it's only mentioned very briefly in the Gospels, which are technically Old Testament books because they are under the law. And the New Testament, or the New Covenant with Christians, begins in Acts chapter 2. So let's talk about what the church is. And I think the best way to get a definitive and really solid biblical definition of the church is, of course, to go to the Bible. There is a law that people who study the Bible have created called the law of first mention, which basically states that the first time a word, phrase, concept, or doctrine is mentioned in the Bible is usually pretty definitive and very important. And the first time the word church is used in the Bible is actually Matthew chapter 16, I believe, up verse 18. And let's give a little background to Matthew chapter 16. That's the famous incident where Jesus asked the disciples, who do men say that I am? And they give him several answers. Some say he's Elijah or another prophet. But then Jesus says, who do you think that I am? And the apostle, the disciple Peter, says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus blesses him and says, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So this is a pretty impressive statement. He says, you're Peter, on this rock I will build my church. Now, unfortunately, there are certain religious groups, specifically the Catholics, who use this verse to justify their idea of the Pope. And the Pope is the leader of the Catholic Church. He wields a lot of power, a great deal of power in the church. And he, in that church, in the Catholic Church, he pretty much, whatever he says goes, and he is considered God on earth. And they use this passage to justify it by saying that Peter was the first Pope, that Jesus actually said he would build his church upon the Apostle Peter. So Peter must be the first Pope. He was the first leader of the church. And there is an unbroken line of succession from Peter to the next person called Pope, so forth and so on, all the way up to the Pope today. Now, that is extremely wrong for many reasons. None of it makes logical, biblical, factual, or historical sense. Peter was never made the leader of the church. In fact, we can see clearly in the book of Acts that the apostle James, who was actually Jesus' half-brother, the half-brother of Jesus, was the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Peter deferred to him as that leader. Peter never wielded any of the power of the popes. He never ruled from Rome. His words were never considered on par with the words of Christ. He was never called the vicar of Christ. He was never considered God on earth like the current Pope is. He was not celibate, even though popes throughout history have seldom been celibate. They were supposed to be celibate and not married. Peter, we know, was married. Jesus actually healed his mother-in-law. So there's nothing about Peter that fits with the popery. However, they use it for their own reasons. And there's no historical evidence of an unbroken line of succession from Peter to other popes. It's just, it's utter nonsense. We'll talk about that a lot more when we get into a video series on Revelation. We talk about the seven letters to seven churches. Another very interesting part of this verse is Jesus says, the gates of hell, the gates of Hades, shall not prevail against it, it being the church. What does that mean? Well, when I was taught this verse, I was told that that means that the forces of evil, the gates of hell, will attack the church, but the church will prevail. So we'd be in a defensive position where we'd be under attack from satanic forces, but the church would always prevail. But when you look at it carefully, just actually read it for what it says the gates of hell. Gates are not offensive. Gates are defensive. If you have a gate around something, you're defending it. So the church will not be in a position of defending itself against the forces of evil. The church will be assaulting the forces of evil, and they will put up gates to defend themselves against the church, against whatever this is that Jesus is bringing forth, and those gates will not prevail. In other words, the invasion, the attack that the church makes against Hades will be successful. So I think that's very interesting. But let's get back to the church itself. What is the church? That word church in Greek, with the language in which the New Testament was written, that word is ecclesia. Ecclesia means the called out ones. That's what it means. So the church is not an organization. It is not a building. I think we're all sophisticated enough to know that just because we go to a building that we call a church, that's not what Jesus is referring to here. And again, not an organization, not a political group. It is not an entity. The church is the ecclesia, the called out ones. It is speaking of individuals. If you have accepted Christ's gift of salvation, then you are a part of the church. You have been called out. Called out of what? You've been called out of the physical, tangible world, and you've been called into the spiritual world. You are now, no longer a citizen of the earth. You are now a citizen of heaven. That is where your citizenry lies. You are called out, you are set aside, you are sanctified. So why does Jesus call out and sanctify and separate the people who accept him and become his church? We're going to talk about that in just a moment, because that is one of the truly most interesting and powerful aspects of this church, these called out ones. And to fully understand what I want to tell you about this amazing destiny of the church, we need to go to further into the New Testament, to the book of Ephesians, written by the Apostle Paul, the greatest apostle of them all, who wrote most of the New Testament. In the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, Paul is giving what seems like some practical advice on marriage, and pretty much what it is. You will find in Ephesians chapter 5 the favorite verse of all husbands, which is, "Wives, submit to your husbands." Every husband out there knows this verse. It's the favorite verse. Submit to me, I am your husband. Of course, a little later on, Paul tells the husband to love your wives as Christ loved the church. Christ loved the church enough to die for it. So our wives are supposed to respect us and submit to us, but we're supposed to be willing to die for her. So I think that's a pretty good deal. I don't think you have a problem submitting to someone who puts you first to the extent that they put you above their own lives. So that's how marriage should work. Men should love their wives so much that they put them ahead of everything else, including their own lives. And as a result, women will submit to their husbands, because of course you want to submit to someone who puts you first. It makes absolute sense. And if we as husbands and wives are both obeying what Paul is talking about here, then we will have profitable marriages. So all good and well, good marriage advice. But then in verse 32 of Ephesians chapter 5, Paul throws a curveball. He says, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." Whoa, what does that mean? Well, first of all, let's look at the word mystery. That word mystery, the word is translated mystery, does not mean mystery in the way we think of it in our English language, where a mystery is something that's hidden, that we don't know. It's something mysterious, you don't know what it is. The Greek word translated mystery is mysterion. Mysterion actually virtually means the opposite of our term of mystery. Mysterion means something that was hidden, but is now being revealed for the first time. So while our mystery is something that's hidden, mysterion means I'm revealing something to you. So the actual translation should say, this is a great revelation I'm going to give you. I'm speaking of Christ and the church. That means that all the stuff Paul's talking about as regards to marriage was concerning Christ and the church. So Christ is the groom. And by the way, if you've read the Gospels, you know that there are several parables where Jesus refers to himself as the bridegroom. So that means that the church is the bride of Christ. Whoa. Wait a minute. Step back. What does that mean? The church is the bride of Christ? If you are part of the church, if you are saved, you are part of the bride of Christ. What does that mean? Well, just think about what it means in our marriages. Remember, marriage, the concept of marriage, the concept of marriage was created biblically by God. And what happens when you become married to someone? The Bible says that when you marry them, you become one flesh. You are the same in the eyes of God. So that means that if you are the church, if you are the called out ones, God sees you the same as Jesus. What else does it mean? Legally, you get everything that the husband gets. When my wife has access to everything that I have. When we became married, there was no more my or hers. It became ours. It was no longer my money or her money. It was our money. This is, we live in our house. These are our children. When I pass away, if I pass away before her, which is probably pretty likely, then everything I have is hers. She inherits everything. And as we live, we share everything. So that means that as the bride of Christ, we have access to everything that Jesus has. And what does Jesus have? He has everything. Jesus is God. Jesus created the world. We have legal right to all of that. And that is pretty incredible stuff to think about. I think we're going to literally spend all of eternity contemplating what that fully means for us to be one with Christ and to be co-heirs with Christ. In fact, in the book of Galatians, that's what we're called heirs and co-heirs of Christ. That means we inherit everything that Jesus has. And that's the whole purpose of the meaning of life. We talked about this back in the early blogs and podcasts. The meaning of life is marriage. Why did God create us? He created us in order to be with him, which means you have to become like him. And this is the fulfillment of that. How do we become like God? How do we become like Jesus? Jesus is God. How do we become like them? Well, when we marry Jesus, when we become his bride, we become one with him. And now that we are one with Jesus, we are like him. Therefore, we can finally fulfill the meaning of life, being like him, so that we can be with him and we can dwell where he dwells in the heavens and have everything that God originally intended for us. So that is how this dispensation, the dispensation of the church, fulfills the meaning of life. And it is the only way it will work, because every other dispensation has failed, and we will see how this dispensation goes down. And of course, there'll be one more after this, which, you know, I'm getting going down the road with this. But this is the dispensation where heaven and earth intersect. So the question might be, okay, if I'm one with Christ, how come I don't own the whole universe now? Well, because we are betrothed to Christ. We haven't married him yet. The marriage supper of the Lamb, that's the title of Christ. The marriage of Christ doesn't happen until the end of the book of Revelation, which is what we'll be studying via video and starting in a couple weeks. So what is our position right now? Right now, we are betrothed, meaning basically we're engaged. Now you may say, wait a minute, that's not quite the same. When you're engaged to someone, you're not married to them yet. Well, in our culture, that's correct. When I got engaged to my wife, you know, I put a ring on her finger and we promised that we would get married at some point soon. But legally, it didn't mean anything. Legally, you know, we were not married. We had no legal standing any different than what we were before I was engaged to her. But in that culture, in the ancient culture, when you were betrothed to someone, you were considered, you were put aside by them, and you were no longer you couldn't see anyone else, you know, romantically. You were promised to them, and that was a binding promise, unlike our engagement where, you know, you get a ring, but there's nothing binding you to that person other than your own goodwill and the promise you make. But in the ancient culture, in that ancient Middle Eastern culture that Jesus lived in and that, you know, the children of Israel lived in, when you were betrothed to someone, when you became engaged to them, that was the beginning of the bond. But since this concept is pretty foreign to us, I want to read an excerpt from the website Koinonia House, which really breaks this down and helps us understand it from the standpoint of the ancient Near East. So the first step is of this of the marriage is called the ketubah or betrothal. It was the establishment of the marriage covenant, usually when the prospective bridegroom took the initiative and negotiated the price or mohair he must pay to purchase the bride. Once the bridegroom paid the purchase price, the marriage covenant was established and the young man and woman were regarded as husband and wife. From that moment on, the bride was declared to be consecrated or sanctified, set apart exclusively for her bridegroom. As a symbol of the covenant relationship that had been established, the father of the groom arranged gifts to be given to the bride, which was symbolic of a promise providing a legal tie between the two. After the marriage covenant was established, the groom left his bride at her home and returned to his father's house, where he remained separated from his bride for approximately 12 months. This afforded the bride time to gather her trousseau and prepare for married life. During this period of separation, the groom prepared a dwelling place in his father's house where he would later bring his bride. At the end of the period of separation, the bridegroom came, usually at night, to take his bride to live with him. Although the bride was expecting her groom to come for her, she did not know the exact timing of his coming. As a result, the groom's arrival was preceded by a shout, which announced her imminent departure to be gathered with him. So if you're looking carefully, I think you see some familiar tropes here. In fact, if you look at the book of John, chapter 14, Jesus essentially talks about how he is the bridegroom. He's coming for the bride. It says, "Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you will be also." Now, this is a comforting verse, one of my favorite verses in the Bible. And so while it's comforting for me, if you were a first century Jew, that sounds exactly like what happens during a marriage covenant. This is the first time that Jesus was making it clear to his disciples that they, as the first members of the church, were going to be the bride, and that he was, in fact, the bridegroom. So let's talk about some of the things that Jesus did that really reflect this ancient Israelite marriage. The price Jesus had to pay in order to atone for the curse of original sin and make the bride eligible for the meaning of life was his sacrificial death on the cross and the resurrection. So that was the groom's purchase price of us, the bride. But like any bride, we have to agree to accept the bridegroom's proposal. So Jesus paid for his bride, but again, the bride has a choice. It wasn't just because, you know, despite what you might see in some ancient depictions of how marriage was, it was not just, at least in this culture, it wasn't just the groom pays the price and now the bride has to, whoever this woman is, she has to go with him and be with him. No, there's a choice. The bride still gets to say no if she doesn't want to be with the husband. Similarly, we have to say yes to the proposal and to the price. And once we say yes, then we are in a state of that sanctification. We are legally husband and wife. We are legally the bride of Christ, and he goes off to prepare a place for us. That's what he's been doing since he ascended to heaven in Acts chapter 2. He's been preparing that place for us, and we are to be set aside, to be sanctified, and to make ourselves ready for his imminent return. We don't know when he's returning. It's going to be a surprise. It's going to happen with a shout, and I'm getting into things that you probably are familiar with. If you're familiar with the concept of the rapture, we'll talk about that down the road a bit, but that's what us being called to our groom is going to be like. He's going to come with a shout and we'll be caught up with him, the harpazo, or raptured up with him to be with him forever. And that's when we're called up, and that's how our position as a church reflects that the pattern of the ancient Near East marriage ceremony. And the final thing I want to focus on are the so-called gifts that are part of the betrothal process. That, you know, the groom's family gives gifts to the bride, and in our case, the gifts that are given to us are by the Holy Spirit, the so-called gifts of the Holy Spirit. And what are the point of those gifts? And those gifts are outlined several places in the Bible, especially the Apostle Paul talks about all the gifts of the Spirit. those gifts are there for our sanctification. Remember, as the bride, we are now in a state of being sanctified, being made ready for our groom. So again, in our case, those spiritual gifts are meant to edify the church and to further enhance that sanctification process. So we all have a gift. Every Christian is given a gift. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, 4 through 11 outlines exactly what those gifts are. And Ephesians 4, 11 through 13 let us know that those gifts are, again, for our edification and for our sanctification as the body of Christ. And that is the purpose of the church in the world. While we're in this waiting process, waiting for our bridegroom to return, that is our purpose in the world. Our sanctification process is to grow in grace and become more right and more just by using those gifts and that edification to become more like Jesus. Why? Because it's essentially training for what the church, what we Christians will do for eternity in heaven. And it earns us rewards. So the level to which we are sanctified on earth earns us rewards in heaven. And this topic is important enough to merit some additional exposition. Actually, it's a pretty important topic. If you break it down, Jesus had two primary messages when he addressed people while on earth. And we talked fairly recently about the true mission, message, and purpose of Jesus. So this will be a little bit of review, but I'm going to just focus on his two messages. Those messages were reward and salvation. That's all Jesus talked about. And if any time he spoke to people in parables or even teaching directly, it was about either reward or salvation. The reward statements were generally in an if-then format. If you do this, then that will happen. For example, the Sermon on the Mount is a great example of that. The Sermon on the Mount is an exposition on the law explaining the why behind all the commandments that seem like they're religious. But Jesus says here, if you do this, you'll get that. Blessed are the pure in spirit, for they shall see God. Blessed are the meek. Why? For they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they who suffer for the sake of Christ. Why? For they, you know, so forth and so on. So there's always a here's what you do and here's what you will get for doing it. And that happens throughout all of his teachings. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus spoke of how to get good rewards, how to maximize good rewards, how spiritual rewards are better than earthly reward, and how to avoid getting judged for losing your reward. And if you really think about it, the Sermon on the Mount is his main exposition, and everything after that, he is breaking it down more and more because the people didn't seem to get it. After the Sermon on the Mount, people were just astonished and amazed by it, and not necessarily in a good way. They say, who is this guy to say all these things? So he took it to a high level with the Sermon on the Mount, and he had to keep breaking it down lower and lower as the people were showing that they just didn't get it. But the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, that is the crux of everything Jesus had to say. So again, when you look at Jesus' subsequent public teachings, all the parables, all the other examples, they're all centered on either reward, that's value and profitability, or salvation, life, everlasting life. Anytime you would hear a parable where it was binary, where you would either go to heaven or hell, that was a salvation message. When it was about people gaining certain levels of things, like the parable of the talents, where, you know, one guy has five talents, one gets five, one gets one talent. Those are about reward. Those are a quantitative, whereas salvation is quantitative. You either go to heaven or you go to hell. Rewards are quantitative. You can get different levels of reward. So why did Jesus... Well, let me back up a little bit because I need to make something clear. It's important to keep in mind that while these two messages, salvation and reward, are related, they are distinct in very important ways. Because the good works that you do to earn rewards do not save you. Okay, Jesus never equates salvation and everlasting life with reward, but they can increase the amount of value that you get in heaven. And again, that's important to focus on because there is the idea that you get to heaven by being good. And I think my listeners are sophisticated enough to know that that's not the case. But again, there are many people in different religions who equate being with God forever, being in heaven, with how good you are on earth. And of course, that's impossible because God doesn't want you to be good to get to heaven. You have to be perfect. You can't earn your way into heaven by doing good works, because no matter how many good works you do, if you do one bad thing, then you are not perfect and you can't be with God. The only way to be with God is to accept the gift of salvation, where Jesus takes away your sin. You can't be, 70% good and 30% bad and get to heaven. Nope, you have to be 100% good, which we can't do on our own, which is why Jesus lived that perfect life for us, and we can take that value that he offers to us. So that's really important. The reason that God wants us to do good works, to feed the poor, to help the sick, to help widows and things like that, which is we talk about throughout the that Bible talks about throughout the volume, is to earn rewards, because that's what justice is. God is just. And so everything we do that we don't get paid back for on earth, we get paid back for in heaven. So when you do good for people and without them paying you back, then God has to pay you back, because God is just, which is what charity comes from. When you give to people who can't give back to you, you get rewarded by God, because all that justice has to equal out. And the more you do, especially according to the teachings that Jesus gave us, which would be obviously the perfect, most complete example of how to get the rewards, the more we do those, the things he told us to do in the Bible that earn us reward, we get the maximum amount of reward. And of course, what I just described is the definition of love: giving without the expectation of getting anything in return. And that's why loving is rewarding to us, because when we give without getting anything in return, we have to be repaid by God through justice. And I would rather have God repay me than man repay me, because God is going to repay me in the most perfect and complete way. And again, it's not to get saved, it's to get reward. So we should actually be reward selfish in that sense. We should try to maximize our reward here. Okay, so why did Jesus focus on those two topics, salvation and reward? Because to Jesus, our spiritual inheritance is getting everlasting life in heaven, and that reward when we get there, those things are far more important than our physical predicaments on earth. I mean, the few decades we spend in these mortal bodies are inconsequential when compared to eternity. You live here, 70, 80, 90 years if you're lucky? That's a speck compared to eternity. So wouldn't it make more sense to focus on those things? Wouldn't it make more sense for Jesus to spend most of his time teaching about those things, not about getting riches and fame and whatever you want here on earth for the speck of time we're here, but to focus on maximizing our eternal spiritual value? But conversely, it also makes sense that people who consider earth their main home world, remember, we are citizens of heaven. Now we are citizens of the spiritual realm. But those who make earth their home, when we're talking to people who believe in other earth-based religions or people who are secular atheists, it makes sense that they would interpret Jesus's message in a way that makes earthly matters more important. That's why when you hear people say, oh, well, Jesus came to preach a message of love, they're poor definition of love, of tolerance, of social justice. They tell you all these silly things that they believe. Jesus was just a man of peace, and all he taught was how to be nice to people and peaceful, and how to get, money and whatever. Here on earth, yes, there are actually preachers who will preach that Jesus taught that we should all be rich here on earth. They're the so-called word faith people, but I'm not going to get into that right now. But I will tell you this, that if you do find someone, whether they claim to be Christian or not, preaching or talking about how Jesus's main message was about how to live here on earth, you can be pretty certain that they are either a heretic if they claim to be a Christian, or they're just completely ignorant of the Bible and of the spiritual realm. So please don't listen to them. Please don't follow them. I mean, Jesus, yes, he focused on certain earthly things like, making sure you're fed, making sure you're clothed, making sure you take care of your family and things like that. But he only focused on those earthly tangible things to the degree that they will increase or impact what goes on in eternity. That was his focus. So just to wrap things up, the church is the ecclesia, the called out ones. If you are saved, if you're a Christian, then you are part of the church. The church was a mystery, something that wasn't revealed in the Old Testament, but Paul revealed it to us, that in that revelation, as it were, was that we are the bride of Christ, that we inherit everything that Christ inherits, and that we, while we're here on earth, our goal is to sanctify ourselves and be ready for our bridegroom when he returns. And while we are doing that, we can earn rewards that we can benefit from when we spend eternity in the Father's house. And that sanctification process is so important that, in fact, the vast majority of what we call the New Testament, everything after the Gospels, from the epistles of Paul and of Peter and John, they all talk about the sanctification and edification of the church. These letters are things that the apostles wrote to the physical church locations around the ancient Near East in the first century, giving them, you know, advice and direction on how to be sanctified, on to how to be more right and just, how to be more like Christ. And interestingly, there are seven epistles that most people overlook. There are seven epistles that were not written, but they were not written by Paul or Peter. They were written by Jesus. That's right. Jesus himself wrote seven epistles to seven churches, giving them an outline of how to be more sanctified. And that is something that you can read about in Revelation chapter 2 and 3. And normally, if we were going to continue in our regular teaching series here on Faith by Reason, my next step would be to go over those seven letters to seven churches, because again, if you want to get it from the horse's mouth, as it were, if you want to get the most comprehensive, complete ideas of sanctification, a complete message of sanctification and edification of the church, they would obviously come from the man, the God man who started the church. So we would be doing a study on the seven letters to seven churches, because they are truly astounding. However, and we will get to those. However, we're going to do it in a different way. We're going to do it as a part of an overall study of the book of Revelation, which is going to be done via video as well as audio, but it'll be mainly a video process, which I began discussing at the beginning of this podcast. So this is the last pure teaching podcast of Faith by Reason. Once we get back into the teaching realm, we are going to be doing it by video. Again, there'll be an audio component for those of you who either don't have the capacity for video or would rather just listen to it. You'll still be able to listen to things in podcast form, but it will be basically geared towards video. So before we get to that teaching in Revelation, the video series, I want to do one final pure podcast that will just talk about why I'm going to video and why I'm doing this verse by verse study of Revelation and how it actually dovetails into the rest of the study of the sixth dispensation, and how it will also get into the seventh and final dispensation, because Revelation really encompasses all of that. So that's going to do it for this week's final teaching podcast. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Be sure to subscribe by putting your information into that right navigation area, and follow me on Facebook and Twitter, where the podcast will be posted. And I will see you next week when I go over that introduction to the new phase of Faith by Reason, the video phase. We'll talk about why I'm doing video. We'll talk about why I'm doing Revelation. And that will lead in the following week directly to the really, really, truly exciting teaching that I'm calling Revelation Unveiled via video on Faith by Reason and on YouTube. So again, thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next week.